Is that being recorded?
First Big Bang. Okay. So the only bad thing is I have to stand over here, I guess. Okay. So, as an outline for my talk, I'm going to start with a very brief review of the evidence for dark matter, because I was instructed to be in at a very basic level, so I will do that. Then there's really two parts to my talk. One of them is telling you about the status of looking for dark matter. In particular, there are several claims of detection or hints of detection, Dhamma, heat, gamma rays from the galactic center. And so I wanted to talk about that and then also tell you about the upcoming experiments that can determine whether or not any of these hints are right. Then the thing that I'm really excited, the thing I've been working on right now, is something we call dark stars. So this is a new phase of stellar evolution in the very first stars that form, caused by the existence of dark matter in these stars. So these stars are made up 1% of dark matter, but they provide a heat source that can be around for a very long time, and we're going to tell you how to detect them over the next decade. I'm very excited about that. So I've been debating which order shall I do this in, because the last thing I want to do is run out of time for dark stars, but... Okay. I also manage to usually talk faster than I ever think I'm going to, so we'll see. But anyway, so it's this part I'm talking about. So this is the basic review that I promised, which is that the predominant mass in galaxies and clusters is made of some unknown dark component. And I'll review how we know this from a combination of arguments from rotation curves, lensing, and hot gas in clusters. So I think everybody knows this, but in case you don't, so here's the Milky Way, and these are the spiral arms, and the sun lives 8 kiloparsecs from the center. It's a big black hole in the middle there. So another picture, this is the spiral arms of this flat part, the disk, and then there's this enormous thing around it, the halo. So here's the spiral arms, and it's this dark halo that we're trying to identify. So I said the first way that you look for find dark matter is from rotation curves. So an analogy would be the solar system. So if I plot the velocity of planets as I move out from the sun, then the speeds drop as you move out, as they should. And you'll notice there's 10 dots here, so don't ask me which planet I added on there, invented or whatever. And Pluto apparently is on there too. But anyway, I like to show this picture because Tycho Brahe lost his nose in a duel and wore a gold and silver replacement. And he's one of the people who studied these planetary orbits and later died of a burst bladder at a dinner with the king. So that's the real reason I wanted to show the solar system, because I like to show it. I think that picture is beautiful. But anyway. Yeah, apparently it would have been very rude. So let's hope we don't have a speaker with such problems. But anyway. You know, there's also, they did some testing of, I don't know how they had any DNA, or something. It might have been mercury poisoning, actually, that killed them. So I'm not sure they really know. But it's a fun story. So anyway, so rotation curves of galaxies are the same thing. So as you move out from the center of the galaxy, the speeds of objects, stars, gas, whatever, is determined by the amount of mass inside. So virial theorem. The speeds are determined by M of R. And slightly different picture than Tycho Brahe. Vera Rubin was one of the original people to study these rotation curves and found that they are flat. So in lieu of dropping off the way the solar system rotation curve did, this is what people expected to see. Instead, this is one of the very earliest ones, they found this flat rotation curve, which indicates that there's a lot more mass than people expected. So if you add in a halo component, this big spherical halo, then you can explain the flat rotation curves. In fact, the sun's velocity without dark matter is already too low, should be 160 instead of the 220 kilometers per second that it is. So we're already being sped up by the dark matter. So then another way to look for this is lensing. This has been discussed already. So if you have some kind of dark object here, then the background light from a star will get bent. And you'll see multiple images, rings, distortions, all kinds of evidence that this... So here's a nice example from a space telescope of some background galaxy being lensed by the intermediate dark matter. This is my favorite one, a very rich cluster. You can see the hundreds of galaxies in here. There's a computer simulation of the amount of dark matter underneath to explain the lensing of this bright object. And even in between the galaxies, there's a big, smooth dark matter component. So clusters of galaxies have additional dark matter. Then the third piece of observational evidence, hot gas in clusters. So this is the coma cluster in the optical or in the X-ray, not to the same scale. But without dark matter, the hot gas that has been seen in here would evaporate. You need some kind of gravitational potential to hold on to it. So as far as dark matter candidates, 10 years ago, there was a lot of interest in machos. I'll mention something about that. So these first three I'm going to talk more about. Too bad that neutrinos can't do it, because after all, they do exist. However, they are too light. It doesn't work. At least for the standard three, it just doesn't work. Primordial black holes, Wimpzillas, Kaluza-Klein particles, there's a host of candidates. I'm going to focus on the first three. So the first point is that baryonic dark matter is not enough, even if you didn't believe, even if you just were looking at the galaxy by itself. Yes, I'm not going to talk about that.
Is that solved, or is that still a problem?
No, there's like a fuse looking for, these are the where are the dark baryons, and so they're somewhere in, but right, yeah. So we don't know where all the baryons are, but there's some. Well, you can see them at a redshift of a few too. Right, but that's not surprising. That's not surprising, right? So, but they have to be there somewhere, yeah. So, I actually had a series of slides on that which I removed, so I'll tell you, but I have them somewhere, I'll show you later. So, simple stuff was ruled out right away for, this is the subject of baryonic dark matter. And there was for a long time a holdout for massive compact halo objects such as stars or stellar remnants or planetary objects, which are stars that are, if they're less than 0.1 solar masses, they don't turn on. So there was a long time people thought this could do it, but so through a series of converging measurements and theoretical arguments, it's been shown that they cannot be. So, for example, faint stars would have showed up in space telescope. These planetary objects, these low-mass things that don't turn on, you could see in other kinds of data sets. So we actually analyze, as you go to lower masses, how many of these things there are, and the answer is less than 3% of the mass of the Milky Way. And this is some of the data, the Macho and Eros data, that also excludes a very large swath of masses, but down to 10 to the minus 7 solar masses. What about stellar remnants? I haven't said anything about those, white dwarfs, neutron stars, and so on. And again, we studied a whole lot of different signatures that you would have had of these things. Basically, if you're going to make a white dwarf, it had to come from somewhere, and whatever star it came from would have made infrared radiation. You would have seen element abundances, carbon, and so on. And it turns out it would have taken an enormous mass budget to make them. And you would have had to have a very bizarre, for some reason, put all the mass, the initial mass of stars into the right ones to get the right mass objects to begin with, to end up with the right mass objects. So after we run through all of these tests, We concluded that at most 20% of the halo can be made of stellar remnants. At that point, originally we were in disagreement with some of the experiments that were claiming 100%, but they're now actually below 20%. So we're all in agreement on this point. So there's some fraction of the halo that could be made of white dwarfs, okay? So the dark matter, there could be a significant amount of white dwarfs in the halo. But that still leaves most of it unknown. So I have nothing to say about this. So the good news is that if we are going to have to talk about some kind of non-baryonic particle, it'll be somebody pleasant to be around. No, I'm just kidding. So cosmologists don't need to invent new particles, because in the interest of solving various particle physics problems, there's already two candidates that are around independently of the dark matter problem. So these are the WIMPs and the axions. So the axions were proposed as part of a solution to the strong CP problem, and they have mass, very light masses, in the 10 to the minus 3 to 6 EV range. And I just thought I would briefly put up the status of the experimental status on looking for these things. So the most sensitive experiment, this one here, is this 80. So this line, I can't point with this thing. The pink lines are from the ADMX experiment at Livermore, which uses the fact that it's the coupling, it's the photon is coupling, so you have a magnetic field, and the axion produces photons if in your detector. So you can see that these experiments, these are these red lines right here. I think I said the wrong thing. This is not the experimental. This is the theoretical range that you're interested in particular down here. And this is the experimental regime, and they're really starting to push into the theory. So let me back up since I said the wrong thing. These lines are theory, and this is experiment, and it's starting to get interesting. So we can hope maybe they'll find something. Yes. Sure. That's in order to solve the dark matter problem. So here you are. This is the dark matter range, the axion window. Up here you'd have too much is ruled out. And then there's all kinds of bounds from supernovae that if axions existed in various types of stars, they would take a lot of energy out. And you wouldn't be able to see the supernovae and red giants that are around, because the axions would bleed all the energy out. So this is the range of interest. This is the mass range that would provide the dark matter. So that's what I've plotted with those these lines here. Now the other, and for the rest of the talk, I'm going to focus on these weakly interacting massive particles. The most popular candidate for this are the supersymmetric particles. So again, this is something that comes out of particle theory. So the motivation is the hierarchy problem. You want to stabilize particle masses as being lower than a gut mass or a Planck mass. If supersymmetry is true, you automatically get new particles. You double the number of particles. So for photons, you get photinos. Quarks, you get squarks, and so on. And the lightest of these supersymmetric particles is the dark matter candidate. Anything heavier decays down to the lightest one. And the reason that this is the most popular dark matter candidate is, I'll explain why. So the mass is somewhere in the range 1 GeV to 10 TeV, and the canonical values that people are interested right now in is 100 GeV. And they're Majorana particles, the neutralinos, which are partners of W's, Z's, and photons, and Higgsinos. These things are their own antiparticles. They annihilate with themselves, which means that in the early universe, when they are in thermal equilibrium, they annihilated among themselves until the universe expanded to the point where they couldn't find each other anymore. So you can calculate how many should be left over today. Okay, so from the particle physics tells you what the annihilation cross-section should be, and then you can compute, of these thermal ones initially, how many are left over today. Okay, and the reason that this is the most popular candidate is because the annihilation rate automatically gives you the right answer for the relic density. Let me finish this, and then you can interrupt. I just want to put a number up, and then you can say, okay. So the relic density today is given by this right here, so that an annihilation cross-section of 3 times 10 to the minus 26 centimeter cubed per second automatically gives you an omega that's in the right range, okay? And that's just something that comes out of SUSY. So there are some range of what you can get out of SUSY here, but the fact that you can get something like this is why people are interested. Okay, what were you going to say? Yep.
I was just going to point out, I mean, I think I agree with the point you're making. I was going to say, this connection between the hierarchy problem and Bell Heather is much broader than SUSY. So anything that tackles the hierarchy problem will almost certainly have something like LSP. So it's one that makes a stronger case.
You can make it, there's an even stronger case, because people who are abandoning the hierarchy, trying to solve the hierarchy problem with SUSY, are actually putting in the dark matter. They're saying you have to solve the dark, like split SUSY, you have to solve the dark matter problem, you have to get this. So it's taken very seriously. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what he was trying to say. So if you have these kinds of masses and weak interactions gives you the right answer. So WIMPs, more generally than SUSY, are good news. So just to give an idea of this is to be more accurate, omega versus neutralino mass. Here's the WMAP range. And as you see, I was exaggerating. You don't always get exactly the right answer for omega because there's a whole, well, these are different points in supersymmetric parameter space. Okay, so as far as detecting these things, I was going to talk about a number of these different things. The LHC may find supersymmetry. Then there's the direct detection experiments, where the basic idea is, here's a detector made of some kind of nuclei, and the WIMPs that are moving around in the galaxy hit the nucleus, elastically scatter, and the nucleus, there's some kind of energy deposited in the nucleus, a nuclear recoil, and people try to look for that energy deposit, that slight heating of the nucleus. And this is a very difficult experiment, less than 1 count per kilogram per day. The expected rate is 10 to the minus 3 or something. It's really tough experiments. KEV energies, you have to go in mines, a Sudan mine or underneath the Alps or something like that. And so now I want to ask you, I was going to tell you about the status of some of these different experiments, but I also want to get to dark stars. Should I skip ahead and come back to this, or what do you think? Yeah, I know. Oh, so you think I should just proceed from here? Okay. So I will mention something more about the direct detection, but right now I just want to put up a list of the different ways that one can look for these things. The other one is indirect detection. And here you're taking advantage, again, of this annihilation that I was talking about. So of the annihilation products that you get out are going to be typically a third neutrinos, a third gamma rays, and a third electrons and positrons. So I've just put up the original references on this. When these particles are in the halo of the galaxy, but as they move, for example, through the sun, you'll capture some small fraction of the ones that go through the sun, because they occasionally do interact with the nuclei in there. So then you'll collect a bunch of them in the center of the sun, where they annihilate with one another. And you have the opportunity to look for neutrinos coming from the sun. Okay, so that's the basic idea of indirect detection from the sun, or the same thing from the Earth. The same process also happens in general in the Milky Way halo, or probably a better bet is to look towards the galactic center. Because again, we're talking about annihilation, which means that you'll get the highest count rates wherever their densities are higher than average, okay? So that would be true if you captured them inside some stellar object. It also would be true in the centers of halos, because that's where the dark matter densities are the highest. So you can look towards the galactic center and look for gamma rays. And there have been some hints of this, which I'll talk about. The other thing is that positrons is the other. So these are the three, as I said, the three annihilation products, the neutrinos, gamma rays, and positrons. And you can look for all three of them, and I was going to talk about this in more detail.
Can you get any signatures of dark matter and neutron stars?
You mean capturing them in neutron stars and seeing what it does? Back in the 80s, people put them inside, looked at dark matter inside everything, and I don't remember, but apparently not. The advantage of the sun and Earth is they're close. So let me turn now to three claims of, or hints of, WIMP dark matter detection and the status of these. So the first one is the DAMA annual modulation. So this is an Italian experiment that's in the Gran Sasso Tunnel. And the basic idea of what's being done here, this is an idea we put forth a long time ago. So if this is the sun, and the Earth is traveling around the sun, it's traveling the other way, at 30 kilometers per second, the relative velocity between us and this WIMP halo changes depending on the time of year because of the movement around the sun. So you expect an annual modulation. So what you can do is, even when you've got a signal that's, even if you've got a lot of background, you can still pull out this annual modulation. And that's what this experiment, this DAMA experiment, has done. Okay, so they've got a huge amount of data. In fact, they have a new data release from April 17th, a couple weeks ago. They have an 8 sigma result. This thing is not going away. So this is a sodium iodide detector, and in various energy recoil bins, they've got a huge, huge, huge amount of data, and this thing's not going away. So nobody knows what to make of this, especially because they will not let anybody else look at their data. So when they first came out with it, people said, oh, it's radon contaminant, it's this, it's that, and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, they've actually ruled out all these things. So no one knows what's going on here. Oh, no, this is direct detection, and this is not pointing towards anything. This is just from WIMPs coming from the Milky Way in general.
Yeah.
So
what I'm getting at is, if this is due to WIMPs, then the same modulation should not be seen in other energy bands where there's
I think they have done that.
They have?
Yeah, I think so. Anything, all of these obvious things they've done at this point. So it's perplexing. So I'll show a comparison of that data with other data, but let me just show this first. So the event rate, the number of events per kilogram of detector per keV of recoil energy, is given here. So you've got two components. This depends on the velocity distribution in the halo of the dark matter. Okay, so this is the astrophysics, and then you've got the particle physics, which is the cross section for scattering off of the detector. And there's two different contributions to the cross-section, depending on the details of which neutralino you're looking at. So there's a spin-independent contribution, which scales as A squared, the detector mass squared, and a spin-dependent part, which where there's only a coupling to the spin of the detector nucleus. So let me show you the bounds. Okay, so here's the DAMA. It's not the I don't have the latest DAMA data on this curve, okay? But it's pretty clear that this is already old data from CDMS2 that the DAMA is ruled out if it's made of spin-independent particles, okay, particles with spin-independent interactions. Here's the latest data from CDMS, and there's a new there's a new kind of technology that's coming in now, xenon. So you've got big tanks. They're going to build one-ton tanks of xenon. So this is the way of the future. And this is, at the moment, I think 100 kilograms or something like that. For both, these guys are 25 kilograms, and these are 100. So then you can ask, what about spin-dependent? And this depends on the coupling to the proton or to the neutron. So this is, if you have proton only, the neutralino couples only to the proton. So here's the DAMA data. And then the other bounds that you can place on this come right down here. The strongest ones are actually from the super Kamiokande. So you can see that it's almost ruled out again. So there's a little range around 10 GeV that still survives. Or more generally, you might have a combination of proton and neutron coupling. But that general statement is still true. So if you want to be consistent with the DAMA data and with all the other experiments, there's a very small region of parameter space left for supersymmetry. Now, if it's not supersymmetry, if there's some other kind of interaction going on that for some reason would give you a signal in the sodium iodide but not in these other detectors, so who knows? Nobody really knows what's going on. So let me turn to the next sort of anomalous piece of data. So there's a positron excess. So this is the positron fraction as a function of positron energy seen by the heat balloon. So they found, they were looking at the cosmic ray positron flux and found an anomalous signal. Okay, so this is their data. And the expected signal was down here if it were purely from cosmic rays. And then you can ask, okay, if it were a neutralino, what would you have to do if you want to explain this excess? It's very difficult. So in this example, what we've done is taken a 122 GeV particle, I guess, and in order to get this black curve that would fit the data, we had to assume a boost factor. In other words, take the standard halo and multiply by, I don't even know what the boost factor in here is, but the lowest one we found was 30. So for some reason, the Earth has to be sitting in an overdensity of 30 relative to the average in the Milky Way, which is hard to believe. So it's hard to explain this data. Now, there's a lot of interest in June. There's going to be a data release by Pamela, which is an Italian experiment, also looking for this positron excess. So you'll either confirm or rule this out. It's probably there, okay? So it's probably correct that this excess is there. It's probably astrophysics and not WIMPs, but we don't know. As yet, unexplained. Oh, no, this thing froze. Oh, here we go. So the third anomalous data, gamma rays from the galactic center. Okay, there's a number of data sets here. So this is the lowest energy of them, this EGRET data, around 10 GeV. Okay, so here are the data sets. So you're looking towards the galactic center and you see excess gamma rays. So if it's a 80 GeV particle with a W plus W minus annihilation channel, you can fit this data. On the other hand, if you go to high energies out towards in the TeV range, you've got the Hess experiment, which can also be fit, but barely. It's a 20 TeV particle, so that's barely interesting for if you want anything to do with the hierarchy problem with supersymmetry, so you can barely fit this. But these signals are not compatible, okay? So you've got a 10 GeV signal, a 10 TeV signal. It's not the same thing. So There are, I'm not even going to run through those other hints of WIMP detection, but I mentioned three of them, the DAMA, annual modulation, the heat positron excess, and gamma rays from the galactic center. So, well, what's going to happen next? So one of the big ones is that the LHC is going to turn on, and it may find supersymmetry. And one of the exciting areas for research is to ask, how do these other things, indirect detection and direct detection, if you do this together with the LHC, then what is that going to teach you? Because from the LHC only, there's going to be a huge degeneracy. Even if you have a signal, you won't know what it is. But let's say you put it together with other data. Let's say you have signals in all of these things. It'll sort of be like taking supernovae and large-scale structure to pin down what because the dependences are different, and so you can break the degeneracies by using these other approaches. Especially since there are a lot of experiments that are going to happen. For the direct detection, I've mentioned some of these experiments. It's huge. It's a worldwide effort. The first three being the ones in the United States, at least with participants from the United States. Oh, and the COOP also. This is at Chicago. So as far as the indirect detection, I mentioned PAMELA, which is going to confirm or rule out this positron excess. Ice Cube, these are phototubes in the South Pole that will look for neutrinos. And perhaps the most interesting, so I want to talk about it a bit, is GLAST, which is about to turn on, and it's going to look for the gamma rays. So, again, if you have a dark matter annihilation to gamma rays, then you can hope to see something. And let me just, in supersymmetry, if you, in addition, unify with some grand unifications assumptions, there's a number of parameters that I'm going to show in the next few plots. So this is the Gay-Geno mass. If you unify all the Gay-Geno masses at the gut scale, that's M1/2. M0 is the common mass for scalar fermions at the gut scale. So GLAST, which is based out of SLAC, is going to be able to do the following. So in this M1/2, M0 plane, WMAP is this red region, and GLAST is going to be sensitive to everything below the blue region. Okay? So there's a chance to see something this, and again, combine it with other data sets. You can put a lot of other things on here. So I'm not going to talk about this, but LHC or the PAMELA limits. But again, for PAMELA to explain anything in terms of dark matter, you have to assume a boost factor. Okay, so with a boost factor of 10 and so on. So you can use all these different things together, and people are very hopeful that you're going to find something between GLAST, LHC, and these other experiments. So I think I'm going to, in the interest of getting to the dark stars, I'm going to change topics. So I listed the direct detection and the indirect detection approaches to look for these things, and I'm going to change topics completely to talk about what I've been working on lately. Okay, so this is work with Paolo Gondolo and also with Doug Spoliar. He's a grad student in Santa Cruz who will be applying for jobs in the fall. So keep him in mind. And we've got several papers on this, as well as work with Peter Bodenheimer and Naoki Yoshida. So our basic idea is that the first stars that form can be very drastically modified by the existence of dark matter in them. In particular, what could be really exciting is if the first stars in the universe turn out to be giant hydrogen-helium stars, larger than an AU in size, powered by dark matter annihilation rather than by fusion. So our basic picture is as follows. You have a very large... Let me put up some of the numbers, actually. Come on. Okay, so we're looking at redshifts between 10 and 50. You've got very large halos of dark matter, in other words, 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6 solar mass halos, and you're forming one small star smack in the middle of that halo, okay? And as usual, baryons are only 15% of this big halo. Okay, so you, but then what happens is you have this 10 to the 6 solar mass halo, and in the center, you start cooling. The baryons start cooling, which allows them to collapse and form stars. So you couldn't do this earlier in the history of the universe because smaller halos didn't have the right temperature to allow this cooling process to begin. So that's why it happens at redshifts 10 to 50 in these million solar mass halos. Okay, so as the gas cools and collapses, the gas density goes up. It pulls in dark matter as well. So the dark matter density keeps going up. Now, as I said, you're looking for annihilation is important wherever you've got large dark matter densities. So that was true in the Earth, in the Sun, to some extent in the galactic center. And it's also true in these first stars as they're forming. So for one thing, dark matter density, all density scale is redshift cubed, and you're talking about redshifts of 20, so you gain from that. And you also gain from the fact that the star is forming at the center of this dark matter halo, where the densities are high. So the dark matter, and you're gaining more because this protostellar cloud is pulling dark matter in. So as the densities increase, there's more and more dark matter annihilation until you get the annihilation products get stuck inside the star, heat the star, and stop the cooling. Okay, so you stall the standard star formation process with this new heat source inside there. So you have a gas cloud, which is supported by dark matter annihilation. Now, if the heat source were fusion, you'd call it a star, but the heat source is dark matter, so we call it the dark star. Okay, so to tell you about this, the standard picture of the first stars I already started to tell you about. For the dark matter, the density profile is very important, because as I said, you have to have large densities. And then I have to tell you about the heat source that you get from the dark matter annihilation. The outcome is a new stellar phase, and there will definitely be observable consequences. I don't know why I have this. This is the Bullitt cluster. So the Bullitt cluster, you've got evidence that the red stuff is the baryonic matter. These are two merging clusters. The baryons get stuck. The dark matter goes through each other. So people use this as evidence, claim that this proves dark matter as opposed to Mond and stuff like that, which is probably an overstatement. But anyways, so it does have dark matter and baryons, which is we need both pieces. Now, the first stars, why do you care about the first stars? Well, first of all, finding a new phase of stellar evolution, which is observable, is really cool. What role do they play in the early universe? Well, so it's the end of the Dark Ages. They reionize the universe, which is something that there's a lot of tests of when reionization happens. So also remember, the first stars are made only of hydrogen and helium, because that's all you got out of the Big Bang. Whereas today, you've got all this other stuff around. So somehow, these first stars have to enrich, they have to provide enriched gas for the later stellar generations, so you can make carbon and nitrogen and so on. So for stalling that process, that's interesting. The first stars are also precursors to black holes, which power quasars. So, there are numerical simulations of how these first stars form. There's a standard picture that has emerged that we think changes. But Naoki Yoshida gave us these pictures. So you're starting to form structure here, 0.3 megaparsec, large-scale picture. And then, as I said, in the center of one of these halos, you have a self-gravitating cloud on much smaller scales. You start to form the star. This is from Abel, Bryan, and Norman. Number density as a function of radius. The number of density as time goes on goes up. So this is a star of 1 parsec, a protostellar cloud, and it collapses and cools, and the density goes up as time goes on. So these are in the typical standard picture of POP3 star formation, this is the kind of thing they get. They get a 20,000 Kelvin protostar. In order for the primary cooling mechanism for these things, since they're made of hydrogen and helium, is molecular hydrogen cooling. Okay. So I'm not going to go through all of this, but there's a lot of different mechanisms that contribute to this cooling. And so the temperature, the standard temperature, as you go to the right, the number density goes up, which means that as time goes on, you move to the right here, and the temperature follows this kind of curve depending on the different contributions to the molecular hydrogen cooling. In the standard picture, there's two scales that are important. One of them, when the density gets up to 10 to the 4 per centimeter cubed, which is down here, then the mass of these objects exceeds the Jeans mass of 1,000 solar masses. So that's one of the mass scales that's interesting. So the mass of the final star could be anything as high as 1,000 solar masses, because that's what is allowed to collapse by these gravitational arguments. However, to keep collapsing, you have to cool. So in the standard picture, as that density goes more and more up, the final object you end up with is 10 to the minus 3 solar masses. This is the standard picture of POP3 star formation. Then you accrete some of this Jeans mass back on, and people argue that the final stellar mass should be about 100 solar masses. Okay, so this is sort of the standard process, which we are about to try to change. So we're arguing that somewhere in there we're preventing this collapsing gas cloud from cooling any further. And I put this same slide up before, but just to show you, we're going to use that same annihilation cross-section. So for our canonical case, here's the annihilation cross-section, the same neutralino mass. We'll consider a variety of masses and cross-sections, so masses between 1 GeV and 10 TeV in a range of cross-sections. Again, these results wouldn't have to be specifically for the neutralinos, could apply to other candidates.
Fraxions?
No, not fraxions. We'd have to rethink things. I'm not sure I trust things. You'd have to go to very, very high densities in the standard of as that gas cloud collapses to very high densities before you get a heat source. I'm not sure I would trust my results that high. We have to think about it more. You know, I haven't thought about it. So, again, as the annihilation rate is proportional to the square of the dark matter density, these things have to hit, two of them have to hit each other. So you really have to know the dark matter density. So we put a lot of thought into figuring out what is the dark matter profile inside these things. So, all right, so structure formation in general, this is from the Santa Cruz group. The general picture of structure formation, because it's going to apply to our stars also, is that you make smaller objects first, okay, and then they merge into galaxies, clusters, and so on. But no matter on what scale, the numerical simulations give you the same answer for the density profile. The Navarro, Frank, and White profile, and FW profile should be an E. Okay, so here it is. So as you move out in radius, you've got near the center of the object, you've got a 1 over R drop-off. And then as you move past the scale radius RS, it becomes a 1 over R cubed drop-off. So near the center, this 1 over R is what we are relying upon to get our answers, okay? So there's two parameters in here, the central density and the scale radius. We can exchange these two parameters for two other ones. And this one, the concentration parameter, is defined to be the ratio of the virial radius to this scale RS, where the virial radius corresponds to where the dark matter density is 200 times average. Okay, so I was going to originally use these parameters, maybe I won't. But anyway, so you have this. So the key for us is that you have this 1 over R profile near the center of the object. So now what happens? As I mentioned this before, as the star starts collapsing, it pulls the dark matter in. And you have to compute what does that do to the dark matter density. So we start with the 1 over R that you get out of any numerical simulation, but it steepens, okay? You're going to get even more dark matter in the middle. So the first thing we did was follow the Blumenthal et al. Prescription for doing this. It's called adiabatic contraction. So it's basically conservation of angular momentum. And as you, if you do this, then you find the kind of profile we find is an r to the minus 1.9 profile outside of the core. And this is the dark matter density that scales almost with, it scales as n to the 0.81. So the, as the baryon density goes up in this collapsing cloud, the dark matter density follows. Okay, so the dark matter density is going up. So if the blue is our original NFW profile, then as the gas gets more and more dense, from 10 to the 10, 10 to the 13, 10 to the 16 per cubic centimeter, this is the dark matter profile. So dark matter is a function of radius. So you can see that the dark matter density also goes up. Okay? It would have been great if the numerical simulations of the first star formation could have computed what the dark matter does, but they don't have the resolution. They can't do it. This is as far as they can go, is these black dots right here, which corresponds to about a 10 to the 8 GeV per cubic centimeter density. But so with this, what we did originally is these very simple, this simple Blumenthal method. The bizarre thing is how well this actually works, it turns out. So the original work, In general, there's three adiabatic invariants to do this problem. We're going to assume spherical symmetry, so one of them is automatically zero. Then the Blumenthal method only conserves one of them, angular momentum. So it's equivalent to saying, considering only circular orbits that don't cross each other. Okay, so you have circular orbits that are moving in. Very limited range of validity. And yet, bizarrely, it works in an enormous, the range with, over which it works in parameter space is huge. But so what we've done now with Jerry Selwood at Rutgers is include also the radial orbits, and we found that our naivest results were only high by 25%. Okay, so we really do feel, and now we're also doing numerical simulations with Marcel Tsemp and Santa Cruz to confirm this yet again. We really want to get this density right, but apparently we have. Okay, so what is the dark matter heating? Well, the heating rate, as I said, has this dark matter density squared times the cross-section, so n sigma v, that's just the rate for the dark matter annihilation. And then you multiply by the neutralino mass, because that's what's being converted into the annihilation products that you're capturing. So this is number density, or in terms of mass density of the WIMPs. Here's our heating rate. The other question, though, is of the annihilation energy, how much of it gets deposited in the gas? So we have to multiply our heating rate by this, we call the parameter FQ, which is the fraction that you actually capture in the gas. So in order to estimate this, I've said this before, the annihilation products are typically one-third electrons, positrons, one-third photons, and one-third neutrinos. The neutrinos are useless for us. They just escape from the star. So the biggest FQ is ever going to be is two-thirds, roughly. And previous work actually tried to look at this dark matter annihilation in the first stars, but they stopped at a number density of 10 to the 4 per cubic centimeter, at which point the annihilation products just escape. So you have to go to higher number densities for the baryons in order to trap the dark matter. So that was... we got out using stuff from the particle data book. We figured out what it would take to trap these things. So there's a crucial transition when you get to sufficiently high densities. Most of the annihilation energy is trapped inside the core and heats it up. So, for example, for our canonical case of 100 GeV, when the gas density gets to 10 to the 13 per cubic centimeter, that's when you're able to trap, actually a little lower, but anyway. So that's when you're able to trap the annihilation products, okay? And then the dark matter heating dominates over all the other cooling, over all cooling mechanisms and prevents the further collapse of the core. So depending on the neutralino mass, you get a different estimate for when the dark matter annihilation products are trapped. So I'm sorry, they actually get trapped at 10 to the 11, but they don't win over the heating until 10 to the 13. I mean, they don't win over the cooling until 10 to the 13. So these were our first estimates of trying to observe this happening. So This is the temperature of the star versus number density. Again, as time goes on, the density of the gas goes up. So moving to the right is moving forward in time. The blue curves and the blue and green curves are the usual case, the standard POP3 case, POP3 being these first stars. So what we have is, depending on the mass of the neutralino, we have the red lines are the new contribution, and when you're above the red lines, heating dominates over cooling. So what you have to look for is when do the red lines cross the blue one, and that depends on the mass. But so, for example, for the 100 GeV case, that happens at around 10 to the 13th per centimeter cubed, and beyond that point, you stop. You no longer collapse. The molecular hydrogen loses. Okay, so yeah, that's where things get interesting. And if instead of changing the mass, you want to change the cross-section, that's easy, because the annihilation rate scales as cross-section over mass. So Naoki Yoshida actually took this and put it into his much more sophisticated code than the mathematical one that we wrote, and confirmed that we got this right. So in fact, he found here a dip in the temperature because the annihilation products produce extra electrons, which actually encourage your cooling, speeds up your cooling briefly. And then it's, when you reach these black dots, actually I should remove these lines up here, they don't mean anything. But when you reach these black dots, the cooling of the star, so the star stops collapsing. So that's when we have something interesting. Ordinary baryons, yes. It's the stellar density, the baryonic density as the star is collapsing, its number density goes up.
And the rate of that is also affected by that?
No, not at all.
So that is the same?
No, we just took that's a result of simulations from the first star guys who didn't pay attention to the dark matter at all in this thing. You mean you want to go beyond neutralinos now?
No, actually, I was thinking, so think about M supra, this minimal thing. So, people like to take candidate points in the parameter space and they give you the right relic density. Mm-hmm. As long as they give you the wrong density, you don't really care. But they do have different chronology, right? I mean, for example, the co-annihilation, if co-annihilations are important, then you still get the right relic density, but will that affect the way in which they start? And there's, some other...
Okay, so how much of that stuff is going to be around in dark matter halos, other than your neutralino, other than your LSP? Nothing, right?
I guess I'm wondering what it means for different ways in which they annihilate.
Well, I mean, they could, in principle, annihilate off of some other Suzy particle, but those things aren't there, right? Okay. So what do we have? So far we have this thing we're calling a dark star, supported by dark matter annihilation rather than by fusion. At this point, they have masses like 1 to 10 solar masses. Their radii are 10 to 1,000 AU. Okay. The power of darkness. The dark matter is only 2% of the mass of the star, but provides a heat source. The only thing that's dangerous about the name dark stars is that these things are not dark. Okay, they're made of dark matter, but they do shine. And in fact, the luminosity at this point is 140 times the solar luminosity. So this is what we get right at the end, right at the point where the dark matter annihilation starts dominating. Now, what we're doing now is doing the stellar structure of these things, and I expect we're going to have a paper out next week. But I don't want to tell you because I want to make sure we do it right, okay? So it's I'm not saying that these things, in the end, when they settle down into hydrostatic equilibrium, have exactly 100 solar masses. But we are finding hydrostatic equilibrium solutions. We're going to tell you what luminosity these things have. We're going to tell you what temperature they have as a function of neutralino mass. We're going to make predictions. So I'm excited as hell. Yes.
So supposing there was a dark matter, then all simulations, and if that's mass about 11.
But you don't stop here. You keep the number density of the baryons continues to rise.
But at that time,
yeah.
They know what the luminosity was. I just trying to understand the difference. So supposing there are no dark matter.
These numbers are all exactly the same as in the standard case at this point. That's how we get them. Okay? So this is our, for the stellar structure, this is our starting point now. Okay?
So these are the standard numbers.
Yes, these are the standard numbers. Okay, key question, how long do these things last? If they lasted a year, bah, we wasted our time. But I think they last a lot longer. So, one calculation you can do is ask, how long does it take the dark matter in the core to annihilate away? So for, I think it says under there, for example, for 100 GeV, though it does. The lifetime is then 600 million years. So if you have, remember, you have a million solar mass halo, you have this tiny little star in the middle, how long does it take the dark matter to all annihilate away inside the star? The answer is 600 million years. Now, things could happen, okay? It is possible that the core could fill in again, right? You've got the million solar mass reservoir sitting there. Non-trivial problem. Nobody has the numerical resolution to answer a question like that. What do exactly the orbits do and so on? Non-trivial problem. I mean, if that were true, you might even see some of these things around today. I don't know the answer to that. So, so these numbers may change, but naive guesses of a million years for these times for these things to last is pretty good, I think. Okay, so if this is true, what observables are there? Other than, well, the big one is you can look for them directly, but reionization would be delayed. Okay, you'd have to wait until the dark matter runs out, and then you return to the standard picture in order to do any reionization because our stars are too cool. Well, you can, with upcoming measurements of the 21-centimeter line, you can hope to study the reionization history of the universe and determine whether or not we're allowed to put, whether we're inconsistent with that. Now, it's also true that there are, I'm going to try to remember, at a redshift of 6, there's 10 to the 9 solar mass black holes, or is it the other way around? Anyway, there's huge black holes that are produced early in the history of the universe. Nobody knows how to make them. But if we start with bigger objects than in the standard picture, maybe we can make these black holes. So I'm not sure about that. But the, as I said, the biggest observable is looking for these things directly. So the James Webb Space Telescope, which is the sequel to the Hubble Space Telescope, is what's a $4 billion satellite. And one of the motivations for putting it up there is to see the first stars. So they should be able to tell the difference between the things we say are out there compared to the standard picture. Someday you might hope to find the neutrinos that came out of the annihilation. But at the moment, the angular resolution, I think it's a few degrees, is totally inadequate. So the current detectors can't do it. Ice Cube or anything, they can't do it. So you're looking, who knows. So to conclude this thing, I just want to tell you the first stars, the first stars live in a dark matter-rich environment. And their heating in these first stars can delay or block their production. And we have a new stellar phase, the dark stars, driven by dark matter annihilating and not by fusion. And I'd like to go on for a few more minutes. There's what happens next? Once you run out of dark matter, you're eventually going to get the normal procedure that you get deuterium burning, the temperature goes up, the object contracts, temperature goes up, you get deuterium burning, you get fusion, star reaches the main sequence. You will get that eventually. And I don't have time to talk about this, but even when you do reach the main sequence and you do have fusion going on the core, it turns out dark matter annihilation there can be very important. So if everything I've said so far is wrong, that dark matter annihilation didn't matter in the protostar, it's going to matter in the main sequence star. Again, it can be the dominant heat source. It can determine the mass of the stars. Okay, so I don't have time to talk about this. This is our more recent. This is our paper in February. But just so let me just say that once you reach the fusion-driven phase, there's actually a new effect that kicks in, which is that the number density is high enough that you capture WIMPs that move through you also, okay? So you have another mechanism kicking in. The dark matter luminosity can be very high. It can be so high that it prevents the stars from growing. It prevents anything from accreting onto it. It provides a pressure that stops the growth of the star. It controls the mass of the stars. So you have a second phase. I should have just talked about stars and not talked about observational limits on dark matter. But anyway, I think I better stop. Dark matter is made of something that annihilates that the... We took 100 GeV particles that annihilate among themselves.
So if you don't find... if you don't see this in 2170 or something like that, you kind of want to conclude that the dark matter
is better. You mean if reionization is happening at a redshift of 40 or something like that already? Possibly. It'll constrain the annihilation cross section anyway. I know. I used it to get these things, and I'm saying now. Yeah. Well, you haven't. You have maybe an order of magnitude freedom in the annihilation cross section. In some, there are, in fact, in minimal supergravity, there's some regimes where you can go down several orders of magnitude and still get the relic density to come out not too bad. It's a very small regime in parameter space. Yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right. You know, I didn't have time to talk about the rest of this stuff, but if you find stars of a given mass and you understand more about and you work out this kind of stuff more, you can put some powerful constraints on the dark matter from this stuff, even more than from the first star. So yes. Yes, you can go back and learn about WIMPs from the stars, yes.
So this would be the kind of that any particular star that you see that you've got a bunch of dark matter inside
it? Well, the first stars. No. This is the first stars. These are the first stars, but after they have fusion going, because there's the because remember the first stars form in the middle of these halos at a high enough redshift that the density dark matter densities are big. So location and time matter. The sun is 8 kiloparsecs from the center of the Milky Way. Who gives a damn about the dark matter? You can capture some in today to find, but in the formation process, it certainly didn't matter. No. The today stars, everything that I was talking about was the first stars, okay? So the part one was the protostellar collapse. And part two is after you get fusion going in the first stars. But still the first stars. Okay, different stages of the first stars. So we think there's a dark star phase where you actually stall and have this annihilation driven. Then you get fusion going. But again, you've got a dark matter contribution to the which... And both of these stages can be used to constrain dark matter properties, but the second one more than the first one. I'm not sure about that. But. So, yes. Okay.
There, the whole idea was that the WIMPs are just going through right now through the stars.
Were you talking at... I want to make sure, in both of those, I'm talking the first stars, not today's stars.
Okay. I don't know why is it first stars.
Okay, for two reasons. The densities go as redshift cubed. So dark matter density around the sun is just not high enough. Okay, so redshift cube buys you a huge factor, 20 cubed, and location. The first stars formed in the middle of the halo where the densities, the density goes peaks in there. Whereas the today stars form all over the place. The galactic center, you're still interested in annihilation there. But out here,
So the density factor cannot make up for the, I mean, the density of the star factor cannot make up for the density of the low dark matter. I'm supposing I just consider neutron stars, for example.
Yeah.
Then I just don't know what the order of magnitudes are.
As the density of the baryons goes up, you get, as I said, this new thing going on, the capture happens, okay? So that helps. That definitely helps.
Supposing I took a neutron star versus sun, then I get 10 to the 14
factor. I don't remember about what about he was asking about neutron stars. I don't remember what the general picture about neutron stars is, but they're not that close to us, right? So, but you're wondering if during the formation of neutron stars they're affected? I think the densities are just too low today.
So I'm asking a question about this principle.
Yeah.
Are we saying that, for example, Dalant's or the evolution of neutron stars, which wasn't very much there, you know, in the standard scenario, is going to be changed because these neutron stars are capable of capturing these kinds of things, and therefore...
Okay, I don't know the numbers offhand for neutron stars, but I guarantee you that 20 years ago, when people were looking in every star in the world, that somebody looked at neutron stars to see whether or not there's an effect, and the numbers just don't work come out that way. Okay. On neutron stars?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so maybe I'm wrong about that.
Yeah.
Come on. I mean, that's a no-brainer. I mean, why would you look at why would you look at the sun if you had a neutron star to choose from? The numbers just obviously don't work, but, you know.
I have a very basic question. I mean, the very first few slides for galaxy rotation curve, right?
Mm-hmm.
The velocity was to pass the distance.
Mm-hmm.
What is the metric used in the measure of this distance? What is the metric used? Is it Friedman-Raoult's metric or Gauss metric or
Well... Well, yeah, it's just locally you don't worry about the expansion of the universe doesn't matter. Once you get into a very overdense region, the Hubble expansion doesn't matter. Like, you and I are not expanding away from each other. So it's just Newton's laws.
Because you want to get back to this first class.
Yeah, I apologize. I was trying to cover far too much material.
Wait, sorry.
We're up on Dhamma? Okay, yeah.
Supposing the Dhamma claims are correct.
They're correct. Yeah, then we've got a puzzle on our hands.
The puzzle is that
there are the other experiments. Well, if it's a neutralino, it has two types of interactions. And so there's bounds on those other types of interactions from other experiments, which would rule out the Dhamma results as being correct. So for example, if it's spin independent interactions, then the CDMS and xenon experiments place bounds that are many orders of magnitude lower than what Dhamma saw.
Right. So that
was spin independent. Spin dependent.
If Dhamma is correct, then we conclude therefore it cannot be spin independent.
Right.
We go to spin independent.
Fine, and then you have a small regime of parameter space less than 10 GeV left.
And why isn't that very good?
Well, because for the standard neutralinos, there's actually bounds from accelerator bounds that it has to be heavier than 30 GeV. Okay, so, but there's some wiggle room left. But for 10 GeV, let me back up. For 10 GeV, minimal supersymmetry has already been ruled out, so you have to go to something more complicated. So maybe.
So it could be that there
yeah.
is Dhamma. I mean, I could spin it
around
and say that.
Yes.
Supposing it was an experiment.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's actually telling me something which
very important. Very important. But nobody believes Dhamma. That's the bottom line. Okay? It's just a fact. Why? Because the way they present their data is so weird. The way they bin their data is weird. Everything they do is weird. Yep. If people believed the Dhamma result right now, there would be a major uproar. Okay. Yep. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that that people don't believe the data. So the need to go to Exotica is not felt very strongly by the community as a whole. Is it worth examining? Yes, of course.
Well, of course, it's not even the other. I mean, if you have a lumpy dark matter model, it's not
Well, and I have that in here too. So there's streams. There are the people used to think the Milky Way was a smooth, nice isothermal halo. Okay, apparently not. Apparently there's all kinds of substructure. For example, what? Oh no, it's a fact. For example, on the other side of the Milky Way, on the other side of the galactic center, there's a little galaxy, the Sagittarius dwarf, and it's being ripped up. So there are streams coming off it that you can see the stars coming off it, tidal streams, and one of them comes, I don't know, not that far from the Earth and not that far from the Earth and Sun. Well, if you have a galaxy being shredded apart, how are you going to do that without pulling dark matter with you? Okay, so the if one argues. Well, I don't care what the dark matter is. If it's being shredded up by the Milky Way, it's just gravity. Well, hold on. I wanted to address. Let me make a point about this. Okay. So, all right. So you have this galaxy being shredded. Okay, and you see this tidal tail. And so, if we assume there's dark matter coming along with, and let's assume for the moment, I want to tell you what we did. I have the slides, but by the time I find them, but anyway. So. What that means is that in addition to the isothermal sphere, you would have this tidal stream. And you would see that in your data. And if you have enough data, what you would see is you'd see a contribution up to some energy cutoff. Okay? Because you know the velocity, you know everything about this stream, there'd be some energy cutoff. And you could watch, you could look for that cutoff in your data. And DAMA definitely has enough data to see this, and they don't. Okay? For example. So, at least they haven't. I told them to look for it, and I haven't heard anything. So I guess they didn't find it. Does that prove anything? No, I guess not. But so what was my point? The Milky Way is likely to be a complicated beast, and we computed for different streams how that would affect the annual modulation. And you could, depending on what the dark matter is doing, you could even reverse the sign of the modulation. In fact, depending on the energy recoil, the sign of the modulation will flip, and you can figure out what the whip mass is. So I'm muttering at this point, but I can explain this all later.
Yeah. But it's not clear that the signal that you would expect to see is the backward signal that they see. There are things that you can tell. There's not particularly baroque things you can do to your understanding of dark matter that would mean that your signal wouldn't then correlate with their signal. So it's not, they have this correlation, but it's not clear that the correlation is explained. It's even necessary to explain theoretically by the dark matter that they have. There's only some subclass of dark matter models
they're measuring lamps, so we actually know this model. So they don't have a choice. In this case, I think there really is a problem. I would have said there were some odd examples of dark matter, but you don't.
But the point is the direction of the sky in which you can speak.
Streams can mess up your phase or your modulations. Wait, what? No, there's nothing. I mean, what they see could be perfectly consistent with being a wimp. No. You would still get this. We put in random streams and da 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 da. You would still get this. You could move the peak date and stuff like that, but you'd still get a modulation even with stuff like that going on. So this, what they have is perfectly consistent with wimps. It's not consistent with any other data set. Wait, I can't hear you. It's
the
what?
In phase with the rotation. Yes.
They get it exactly with the phase. They get the phase exactly right for the standard isothermal halo.
Yeah, but that doesn't happen.
Yeah, it does. With caustics, it would be flipped. Or with WIMPs as a function of energy threshold, you could see it flip. Or depending exactly what your streams are doing, you could change it, but you don't have to have exactly, you don't know what streams you have other than the one I just said, which doesn't do anything like that, so. No, 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 I'm talking about their streams. There are streams here, though. I mean, I know, but I'm saying the stream I'm talking about came from the other side of the Milky Way, but it is here. But it doesn't, I don't think it doesn't have to mess this up. No, it doesn't. It doesn't generically mess it up. It might not. I mean, this is not at all unreasonable.
Like, it's almost suspicious that it lines up so well with this tiny pedophile, because you'd expect it to be separation.
Well, I mean, for example, the stream that I was talking about doesn't change the doesn't change this phase at all. It doesn't affect it, so. Wait, to resolve what? Sorry.
The
I mean, keep taking other data, like you said. I mean, and you know, I don't know. I mean, what else can you do? And or invent things that would be consistent with both. I barely know what that is. L goes like some velocity to the fourth power. God, I don't. I know very little about this. Yes. Oh, I mean, I'll tell you other things that go wrong. Let's say NFW is completely wrong. So we got our densities wrong. By the way, we also started, I doubt it, because we also started from a core, which is an extreme case, and it still would happen. But the number, it would happen at a slightly higher density. It still would happen. So yeah, it happens, as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. Then again, the densities that you might have to go to slightly higher densities to get it to happen. But it would happen, yep. Mm-hmm. And so yes, you can go backwards and bound your dark matter in a big way. As I said, you get it more out of this stuff. This later stuff. You get really, really powerful bounds, actually. So yes. I'll show you some. Just want to see some pictures. Okay, so these are scattering cross sections up here. Okay, and I don't know where the pointer went. WIMPs off of nuclei. And here's the mass of a star as a function of dark matter density inside there. Which right now we don't know that well inside the fusion-driven stars, okay? Because you have to follow the whole protostellar phase to get this right. So with this we don't know very well. But once you get this, let's say you find... Oh, I think on the next slide I have it. Let's say that you see a 10-solar mass star. Then for this cross-section, the density of 10 to the 14 GeV per centimeter cubed and 10 to the minus... 4 centimeters squared is the maximum. This is the maximum. This is the maximum cross section you would be allowed then if this were the right dark matter density, because otherwise, if the cross section were higher, then this would play too much, it would be too important. Give me 5 minutes, I'll say it more intelligently, but I think you get what I'm trying to say.
So what is the
Yes. 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 you can constrain the cross-section with these observations. These are, in this case, it's scattering cross-sections because the annihilation range is actually determined most by the capture, really. So it's a slightly different mechanism. In equilibrium, the annihilation equals the capture. I don't know. Sorry. Yeah, I don't know.
Any other questions? Comments?
If I may just go back one thing, this. Okay. So, when you started with this first class, we were talking about the formation, the very beginning. Then you have some mass and you have some luminosity.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point I thought was that, in fact, this, if they had captured these strips, then, in fact, the temperature is going to be higher than what other people can if there were no waves.
Lower.
Lower?
Yeah. You, because in a standard picture, you keep contracting, and the internal temperature rises. Sorry? Yeah, and the point is to get to the, that as this, yeah, so as the thing contracts, its temperature is going to go up, and the fusion, whether or not you get fusion, it scales this temperature to some very large power. So you have to wait for the temperature to hit a million degrees or 10 to the 7 or something, 10 to the 7, to get fusion going. But you're stopping that contraction earlier, so you're providing a support against.
Right. So, but before getting to the fusion level.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
The annihilation is also still causing the annihilation of the individuals themselves. Releasing some heat, right? So therefore, at that stage, before we come to the fusion stage, so you've got a whole bunch of gas.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about this first class and people did simulations, and then there was some ratio about luminosity.
So in equilibrium, I mean, as a star contracts, typically half of the energy goes into luminosity, and the other half goes into heating it up. So you're preventing it from doing that. So in equilibrium, you'd be in hydrostatic equilibrium, and you would have the heat, the amount of heat produced by the dark matter equals the luminosity of the protostar. All of these things have to be in equilibrium. And we are finding, we're getting that, okay? And it prevents that. I mean, usually what happens is that you have a luminosity in excess of what your heat source is, and then the whole thing has to contract because by releasing that gravitational energy, half of it goes into the luminosity, but half of it heats the star, and so normally it keeps contracting more and more, and then you get fusion going in there, and then you have the sun or whatever. So that's the normal behavior. So you're preventing that from happening. It doesn't need to contract. You're delaying it. Very much so. Simulations. That's where the POP3 simulations, that's where I was showing you a picture of that. So they start out with cosmological simulations, and their resolution is amazing. So then they're able to watch these protostellar clouds form. That's where it happens. If it forms outside in the halo, then there's no effect. So later generations that form out farther out, this is not going to happen. And how much later you have to get for that to happen, I'm not sure. I haven't counted how many of these there would be or anything. Got to do that, I guess.
Uh,
What do you mean, two of what? Two
so
of the...
Well, you know, if you're watching simulations, you know, things are kind of emerging like that. Right? So
yeah, what's the time scale for that? I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Well, that's not what happens. I mean, I'm going to resort to saying this is the standard picture, you know. So I don't know what the timescales are, but apparently this is not what happens. It's a question of time, relative timescales, and I don't know the answer. But apparently this is the way it is. Because these zero-age main sequence stars, this is what they do. And some of them live a long time. You mean like a memory stick or something? No. Do you have one? Oh, maybe I do. You know what? Maybe I do. Let me see. Actually, I think I might. Oh, missing. All this missing stuff appearing. Little side pocket. Yeah, I got one.